Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker. 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. People think it's just for making tea, but no, no, no. It's good for your veg. It's good for your pasta. It's good for your rice. It's good for cleaning the pots. It's good for coffee too. Make an espresso, then fill it up with hot water straight from your tap and turn it into an Americano. I love mine. For more details, go to cooker.co.uk. On today's podcast, I'm curious about the ownership of space. Now, this might sound like a weird thing to be curious about, but whoever owns space has the power. And USA, Russia, and China are the major players. But could someone like Elon Musk enter the game? Could he be competing against countries? At the moment, the threat from space is not aliens. It's humans. Today's guest is Tim Marshall, a leading authority on foreign affairs. He's reported from 40 countries, working for Sky and BBC, and has written the following books: Prisoner of Geography, great book; Worth Dying For, The Power of Politics of Flags, great book; Shadow Play, Behind the Lines and Under Fire, not read that one yet, but I'm sure it's good; and Divided, Why We're Living in an Age of Wars, good book, I've read that one too. These books are excellent, all of them. His latest is The Power of Geography, 10 Maps That Reveal the Future of Our World. And he dedicates the last chapter to space. Let's meet him. It's Tim Marshall. Tim, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you, Tim. It seems like only 4 years since I was last on.
Was it 4 years?
Something like that.
Blimey. great book. Why don't you tell us what it's about to start with?
Okay. Power of Geography is about how geography partially determines how a country acts, the choices that it makes. Some of them are baked in. I'm not a determinist. You can get around these things. Leaders matter, politics matters, ideas, the people, but it's the geography. It's what direction your river's running. It's where your borders stop and why. It's whether you've got a deep water port, etc., etc. And it's a follow-up to something that was reasonably successful, I'm pleased to say, called Prisoners of Geography. But it's on different countries, different areas, and it's in a new time, a time ahead of what I think will be a new form of Cold War.
Okay, we'll go on to that in a minute. You know, I was listening to a fantastic podcast not so long ago about geography. It made me this person where they were talking about the evolution of civilizations and stuff and how Europe became so dominant. And the argument the guy was making was we were the first people to domesticate animals because our animals are easy to domesticate. And because we domesticated things like horses, we started then deciding we needed to make more metal. And when we decided to make more metal, we decided to make more ships. And we decided to make, and then when we had ships, we decided to go and explore. And then us and Spain and Portugal and Belgium, we just took over the whole world then, apparently. How much truth is in that, do you think?
Oh, yeah, it's resources. As an aside, Japan never needed rubber. And then you get into the 20th century and they start having cars. Well, there's no rubber in Japan. There's nowhere to go and get it. So they went and got it and they did it by force. And part of the Japanese invasion of China and the countries around it is primarily due to resources. So I think that argument is solid. You reminded me of another argument that I made in a book I wrote about 2-3 years ago called Divided, about the growth of walls and fences that divide us. And just as the preamble, I started that by saying that walls began when we started domesticating animals and we started farming. Because up until that point, there's not much point in having a wall, is there, if you're a hunter-gatherer? Oh, yeah, I'll just build this wall and then I'll move on. it was when we had something to lose. And so it's a similar argument, you know, that how one thing leads to another. And, you don't know at the time what it will lead to. But I think that's a perfectly legitimate argument.
In the same podcast I was listening to, they said it's very hard to domesticate zebras, and that's why they never have them.
Jared Diamond, who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel, wrote this fantastic. Well, he wrote a fantastic book, but in it is this paragraph about how if everything had been different, then incredibly well nourished African armies would have been galloping across the European plains on the backs of armor-clad rhinoceroses, and history would have been the other way around. You know, but of course, you can't domesticate a rhinoceros.
Yeah.
But you know, all of that does come back to geography and how it is a determining factor in what happens in life.
By the way, I quote you constantly from your book, Divided, because that beginning, that whole opening section where you talk about people putting fences up, whenever I get into conversations with people about borders, I always say, because it's from your book, do you have a fence around your garden? And it gets them every time. And I think, get rid of it.
It does. I mean, it's not an exact argument, but yeah, when I gave school talks about that, about that book, I used to say, right, who thinks all these fences and barriers, and who wants to bring all these barriers between us down? Yeah, and all the hands would go up, and I say, right, who's in a house? Oh yeah, right, I've got a great idea. When you get back home tonight, knock on your neighbor's door and you say, I've had a great idea.
Yeah, let's see how long that lasts. Yeah, it's funny because it just brings you security, doesn't it? So there isn't another way of looking at it. And as your book, we're not talking about that book, but it illustrates it well. Look, I want to go straight onto space because that's my favorite chapter in your new book. I've thought about space a lot, but never to the depth that you've thought about it. And the idea really is who owns space basically is going to end up with the power. And there's a bit of a power battle going on with it, isn't there?
There is already. Some people express surprise, you know, what is a chapter on space doing in a book about geography? So I set it up by looking at the choke points of the world, the Suez Canal, the Malacca Strait, all the rest of them, because there is a similar geography in space, in the low Earth orbit belt where the satellites are placed. And if you control that, you're going to control A, what goes on Earth, and B, who can escape our planet. And it doesn't have to be a battle. I mean, Star Trek proves that. You know, the Federation gets together. It really doesn't have to be that way. And there are many examples of cooperation in space already. Weather forecasts are an example. But unfortunately, as well as the cooperation, we are already seeing this competition for the geography of it, exactly as we've seen in previous centuries, competition for territory, Earth territory. And it is about who gets to put which satellites where. It is already, I'm afraid, gone into the Russians testing a weapon, a killer satellite, as they're called, which blew up another satellite, one of their own, I hasten to add. And if everybody starts doing that, if it means that the satellites that are up there, especially the military ones, or even the communications ones, because they are very, very strategic in the 21st century, it means that eventually you might have to start putting defensive weapons on them. And then you get into an arms race in space. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that, but I'm afraid that the signs are already that the great powers, primarily China, Russia, and the USA, are already competing for space in space.
I think we should talk about the Russian missile because they're in denial of it, aren't they? I'm only getting this from your book, but they said that they weren't firing a missile, but it did look for everybody else in the world like they're going up there and firing missiles at satellites.
It was straight
from one
out
satellite
of Austin,
to another.
Sorry, straight out of the Austin Powers film. You know, there's this little craft up there and then the pod doors open and this little thing poked out from the pod door and it fired a projectile and it hit another satellite, which happened to be a Russian satellite. The MOD saw it. The CIA saw it. Everybody that watches that world saw what happened. Yes, of course, they denied it because there is a gentleman's agreement, shall we call it, that we're not going to test weapons in space. But that brings us to another aspect of this, and that is that the technology is probably six decades ahead of the legality, the treaties that we have, the laws that we have governing space. And there's a great comparison here. Bear with me on this, Tim. After the Second World War, First World War, because of the Versailles Treaty, the Germans were very, very restricted in what weapons they could develop and have. But because it was 1918, 1919, nobody put in about rockets. And then in the late 20s, early 30s, rocket technology, and the Germans were at the forefront of this, began to kick in. And they started on the prototypes of the V1s and the V2s as early as that, because there were no treaties to stop them. Right, fast forward to 2021. And the laws governing space were written in the 1960s. And they're not legally binding anyway, but even if you were bound by them sort of morally, they talk about not testing weapons of mass destruction in space, because then they were concerned about nuclear weapons. There's nothing about testing a little killer satellite. So, you know, even if they admitted it, they haven't necessarily broken any laws. So we really need to get these treaties up to date.
Yeah, so there's a space treaty from 1967, and then there's a moon treaty as well. Yeah. What's the moon treaty about?
It's a piece of work that required writing then, and it requires updating now. The problem with it is that it hasn't been ratified by many, many countries. There's a whole diplomatic protocol. You can sign up to a treaty, you can even sign a treaty, but you then have to ratify it, and then it has legal basis that you are bound by it in international relations. Well, most countries said, yeah, that's a great idea, and then never ratified it. So even though I can explain to you what's in it, what's it worth? What's it worth is simply that it's the framework now for trying to get a legally binding one. So it says that no state can own space, and no state can own a chunk of the moon, or indeed all of it, which you might think is a good idea, because let's face it, surely it doesn't really belong to anyone, but if it does, it would be common humanity. You know, it's a bit why I would argue for legislation against, excuse me, a company, let's say Coca-Cola, unless they sponsor you, you know, projecting Coca-Cola in massive letters across the night sky. I would legislate against that, because the night sky is common ground to all of us, if you like. Same with the moon. But it's out of date and it's not legally binding. So last year, the Artemis Accords were signed by Britain and Japan, and I think the UAE and America and others. And they agreed that they could have spheres of influence on the moon. Okay, bit 21st century, as long as we all agree, not a problem. Let's face it, we need some of the minerals that might be there, better than despoiling the Earth. What could possibly go wrong? Well, what could possibly go wrong is that they froze the Chinese and Russians out of this for various reasons. NASA is not allowed to cooperate with Russia, for example. China, sorry. But as it's not legally binding, what is to stop the Russians from landing next to the Japanese and getting the pick and shovels out and starting to dig? I mean, who the hell are they to? Well, it's the Artemis Accords. Yeah, and?
Why can't NASA deal with China?
It's because of they're now regarded as a strategic competitor. And consequently, you can't cooperate with them. And Russia was frozen out because of that alleged killer satellite tests. Now, I think it's madness. I think I completely understand great power rivalry. I don't like it, but I understand it. But when it comes to this new frontier, it just makes such sense to do it as Earthlings and not as Americans and not as Chinese and not as Russians. But at the moment, the trajectory is we're going up there as nation states.
Well, interestingly, though, I've interviewed a couple of astronauts, and I've always asked them, I think I've interviewed four now, but I've always asked them what it's like up there, because there's so many different nationalities come. Yeah. And they say they pretty much, I mean, one of them said to me, they pretty much ignore their governments. They're all working sort of outside their governments, because they need to use each other so much. So every time anyone goes up to the ISS, they have to sort of say, what do we need? And they can't get involved in tittle-tattle between Putin and Biden or whoever it is at the time. So they're sort of acting on their own at the moment. But what I'm reading in your book, which I understand, is the leaders are soon going to get much more involved the more we want to sort of mine the moon and own stuff. And also understand how much of the space we want to own. What is it you call it? Low space or something, was it called?
The buzz phrase in astropolitics is vertical sovereignty.
Right, okay.
How high does your sovereignty go? And it's not in the book, but I wrote an article recently for Prospect magazine and did some research in it. And back in the hot air ballooning era, it was France. An advanced stage of hot air ballooning, as just as we were approaching the Zeppelins, so we're talking 1880s or something, France proposed that your sovereignty went 1,500 meters up.
Right. Okay.
that's slightly out of date, isn't it? Britain said no, there is no height limit, but we still haven't agreed it. So to bring it to the 21st century, yes, at what height can you position your killer satellite above my country? At the moment, space doesn't belong to anyone, so wherever I want, as long as it's in space. But again, you know, we need to have laws about these things. Oh, and what you were saying about how the politicians are getting more into it, and of course another thing that's getting into it, which will impact on the nation states, is the commercial aspect of it.
Yeah.
The Elon Musks of the world.
Yeah.
Now, you know, do you remember the the great British, the East India Company?
Yeah.
The East India Company, when it went out pillaging large parts of the Far East and India, was hand in glove with the British government. And I suspect that the commercial aspects of space travel will be hand in glove with the nation states from where they come. And so that's going to impact as well. And, you know, you'll find the multi-billionaire space companies using exactly the sort of pressure on their governments, saying, look, you know, if you can help us out with this vis-a-vis country X, you know, look at the amount of jobs it'll supply or whatever. Or when we go and get the rare earth materials, we will make sure that, you know, the US government gets most. You know, there's just deals to be done. And as I said, most of the trajectory is towards competition in space, not cooperation.
Yeah, I suppose we'll get on to Elon. I'll go back to Elon Musk in a minute. But going back to the Russian involvement in this, Russia constantly, who lost a lot of power in the world, are looking for power. You mentioned it right at the beginning of your book. They want to get involved in things. So this is a big thing for them, isn't it? And so Russia and China, they don't want to join up with everyone else because they want to, well, someone like Putin wants his people to think he has the power. It's an ego, but Russia need to stay, and China need that as well, because they feel like they want to be a super, well, they are a superpower now. And so there's a lot more to it than just let's get up there and see what's going on. There is a massive sort of feeling of the people, like the original space race,
yes, going
to the moon. It's the same thing.
I think there's an element of that in it. But to your first point about they don't want to, well, we're not trying to get them to cooperate. You know, when it comes to this, quite a hard line. And I just think we should make more of an effort. But no, you're right. I mean, the whole Apollo-Soyuz thing, yes, it was about space exploration. And yes, it was about science and all the rest of it. But it was absolutely about who is top dog in the Cold War. And for the Chinese now to have landed on the far side of the moon, as they have, with a craft, not with a man or a woman on it. I mean, that was obviously front page news in China for days. And it showed the Chinese people, you know, what an amazing technological power they are. And it showed for the Communist Party, which leads the country, you see, the great Communist Party of China has achieved this for the great nation of China, because they're actually very, very nationalistic, both the Chinese and the Chinese Communist Party. And yeah, it's absolutely a big signifier of power. The Russians were exceptionally proud during the Soviet era that they were matching and sometimes surpassing the Americans. I mean, Yuri Gagarin, first man in space, not an American, a Russian, the Soyuz, the Sputnik, the satellite. Now, America won that race eventually, which was one of the many dents in the facade of the Soviet Union. But we are going through something similar now. Happily, many countries are cooperating, such as the European Space Agency and the UAE and the International Space Station. But the real hard-edged stuff is between the big three, and they're not cooperating.
I'm going to ask you something controversial here, just going a little way. Was it actually the Germans who won this space race? Was it the German scientists from the Second World War?
Yes. Von Braun? Later did Shavers, or was it somebody else? No, you're right. They won it in two ways, if you're going to go down that avenue, Tim. Firstly, you can make an argument that they got the first bit of metal into space when they were testing their V1s and V2s in the late 30s and possibly early 40s. They got the highest for a vertical lift when they were testing. So you could look at it that way. But of course, yeah, when the Americans reached Berlin, there was a unit that was assigned, go and get the scientists. They went and got the scientists, brought them all back to America, said, right, you're not in the Nazi part, you're not Nazis anymore. You're working for us now. And of course, if you're a Nazi scientist, yep, absolutely fine. I don't want to go to Nuremberg. This is great. And yeah, it wasn't just von Braun? I really ought to know that. It wasn't just the famous Germans, the head of their rocket science. It was the whole teams that then went into the Apollo mission. And without them, the Americans may not have got there to the moon first.
Interesting. And now Donald Trump, not so long ago, talked about the Space Army. Well, I can't remember what he called it. Was it a Space Army?
Space Force.
Space Force. And everyone starts laughing. This is 2019, I believe. So he starts talking about Space Force and everyone's thinking, what on earth are you talking about? Well, when someone, I mean, look, we look at Trump as being quite dumb, but when someone like Trump's going, we need this, then, you know, obviously everyone understands. I suppose we've got to work out why it's so important. And if you do own low orbit or you own any of space, you can start knocking down people's satellites. Then their weapons don't work. That's the way. Our nuclears don't work unless we've got satellites. Is that
That's
true?
Right. That's right. And there's a real danger there, because not only do our nuclear weapons not work, which actually you might argue is a good thing, but not in this context, because if you suddenly find that you can't make your nuclear weapons work, you might think that whoever did that, or whoever knocked out your satellites, has done that because they are about to launch a nuclear strike and it might tempt you into doing it first. So it's incredibly dangerous. There is this mad mutually assured destruction that's been brought up to the 21st century now. You know, it's a Cold War thing, because if you destroy each other's satellites in space, you're going to knock out every other satellite as well, because of the debris traveling around at, you know, 50,000 miles an hour or whatever. But you don't have to go nuclear straight away. You could have a limited satellite war, if you like. I mean, I don't want to be too negative about this. None of this is inevitable. I'm just writing about the possibilities of great power rivalry and geography. So let's say the Russians want to disrupt our election. Fine. I can do a number of things. I can certainly interfere with the government's communication system, but I could also just turn the traffic lights out in Manchester on voting day. That's going to really screw up voting, you know, because most people still vote in person when they can't get to the polling station. The whole city would be clogged. Knock-on effect. Okay, different capital city. I'll just knock out its GPS system and you're not getting your groceries delivered. And tomorrow you might go to the supermarket, but everyone else will have got there first. And there aren't going to be any more deliveries for a few days. And that's just at really low level. You know, you get a higher level, and you can't see where your armies are moving. You can't see where your enemy's troops are moving. You can't see where the shipping is moving. You know, this is how the 21st century economy, global economy, works. It works from electronic communications. So anyone that dominates that, there is a saying now, and it borrows from Halford Mackinder. He was the British geopolitical theorist of the early 20th century, and he wrote this theory about the heartland, about how if you control the heartland, which is basically Eurasia, you can control the world. I won't go into details, but it's interesting that some of the theorists are using that template, and they're now saying he who controls low Earth orbit controls Earth, and there's he who controls low Earth orbit also, and you control Earth because of the satellite system, but you also control who can get out to space, because in a few years' time, that is where you will refuel your rockets to go the long distances. So if you can't get into that low orbit, orbit belt to refuel, you can't travel. So you would be the gatekeeper. It's a choke point in space.
Mm. Yeah. So it's fascinating stuff, isn't it? And I suppose the way our military works now, and I'm speaking to a couple of SES guys on this podcast, Special Forces guys, who have said that, you know, they used to, in a very short period of time, they used to have to go in everywhere. And then suddenly it was drones going in instead of them. Now, I assume drones and also all the robots from that place. What's that place called where they keep producing robots, which everyone looks at? They're dogs and things. And everyone's going, well, they're going to be used by the military, aren't they? What's that? But I can't think what that place is now. Oh, it'll come to me in a minute. But anyway, all those things, I assume they're all using GPS and that's the way they're working. And so, you know, you own the space, then we can't fly drones to kill your people.
Yeah, and absolutely everybody will invest in this because if they don't, they're going to get left behind. And there's a good example of drone warfare last year. Probably remember Armenia and Azerbaijan essentially went to war over Nagorno-Karabakh last year. And the Armenians hadn't invested in drone warfare. Azerbaijan had absolutely poured money into it. And they wiped out the Armenian and Nagorno-Karabakh armor, the tanks, the armored cars. They just smashed them at virtually no loss to themselves, certainly no human fatalities, because they wiped them out with drones. And Armenia hadn't kept up to date. And every single military in the world looked at that conflict. And those that hadn't bought drones immediately started, right, how much money have we got in the budget? Right, well, screw that. Get rid of that. We're going to buy these. And the Brits were already pretty advanced on this. Sorry, we're getting off the subject of the book, but it's all related.
But it's great because in the UK, we always think, oh, we're not far off being one of the big players. You know, we've got some nukes. I don't know that we've got that many left, but we've got some. And we're still in there. We're still at the table talking. But if we've got nothing to do with space, apart from being part of the European Space Agency or something, that's not us. You know, then we have a very low player in this now, aren't we?
Yes, we will. And it's another reason why. This is one of the overarching themes of the book is that if there's going to be a form of Cold War between America and China, and I only use the term because we kind of understand it in a broad brush, because I don't know what it'll be like because it's in the future, but I believe it will be there. And in that world, you will have to make choices when it comes to security, most countries, most players, and Britain is a player. And when it comes to space, we can't keep up. So we will need to, we will probably choose to be under the American umbrella, as we are essentially under the American security umbrella, both for conventional forces and to a lesser extent nuclear at the moment anyway. So the UK is a player militarily. It is. It's got this new aircraft carrier two new aircraft carriers. That's force projection. Yes, it's fairly 20th century, but we're still in the phase where they do matter. They can project force. We've just been, the Royal Marines have just been practicing with their new jetpacks. You're going to get units of Royal Marines with flying around on the, it's straight out of James Bond, but it's here now. They've been testing them this week. We are in the ESA. We are the UK developing a small spacecraft which will grab bits of metal from the lower orbit belt to try to clean up the lower orbit belt, because the more metal there is flying around up there, the more dangerous it is for everybody. Japanese are doing one as well, but essentially litter collection. And our scientists are very good at this stuff, but we are nowhere near the capacity of even the UAE, which sent a probe to Mars this spring. We're not a major player. Militarily, back on Earth, we remain a serious second-tier nation.
Mm. I was interested with that guy, the gravity guy. That's what he calls himself, isn't he? He's got these jetpacks on his, and they put them, because they always thought they'd be on your back, but they're not, they're on your wrists. And I'm watching him play out. And what's so strange is over the last 6 months, it's gone from being, here's me racing cars to here's me doing military stuff. And now he's in full combat gear. And
there you go.
It's so weird how everything actually, if you want it funded, go and see the military and then we can get it funded. Fascinatingly, about I think it must have been about 10 years ago now, something like that, maybe longer, I decided to do a load of short documentaries on the future. And one of them was about space, because I was intrigued by how it just died. And it literally had just sort of fallen away, and no one was that interested in it. We had satellites up there. And I interviewed a guy from Scandinavia, and he said that the leading force now will be commercialism of space. It'll be mining. And they were talking about things like space ladders. And he said it's no longer, so this is interesting because it's come back around again, it'd be no longer countries that are interested. It'll be businessmen, because they'll be trying to get their rockets up. They'll be able to want to mine the moon and da-da-da-da-da. And this was before Elon Musk. And it's so funny how it's really come back down immediately to actually it's going to be countries again, because we need to own that space. But where do people like Elon Musk fit in? You just said he'll probably be subservient to the USA government, but he doesn't need to be, does he? He could start saying, I want to act alone and try and be a peacemaker up there or something.
Well, a lot of the stuff that he does is actually done in conjunction with NASA. I don't know if he'll be subservient. I think they will do it together. Going back to the guest from 10 years ago, it was very fashionable then, and forgive me, but I never bought it, but it was very fashionable to argue that the nation state had gone out of fashion and would never come back. Well, it never went out of fashion, but it's come roaring back into public consciousness. Well, I go back to the laws. You can't just set up an airline and fly into a country. You have to abide by the internationally agreed laws and get permission to go into the airspace. So Musk can't just take off. Eventually, he will be restrained. I mean, this is a long way away as a comparison, but I believe that cryptocurrencies will eventually come under the auspices of, well, the governments will try and get them in. I mean, the Turkish government has just banned people using, I think it's Bitcoin, it's one of them, or it could be all of them, to buy things. Because, of course, well, its economy is a basket case, which is why it's been forced to take some action, that and many other things. But the Turkish government doesn't like the fact that it's not in control of the money. What government would like it? What government is prepared to see the power of their central bank just drain away? There will be legislation, I believe. And similarly, if it comes to this new frontier, which government will be content to let a company say, see that bit of the moon? That's ours.
Yeah.
They won't. They would rather get together and agree to divvy it out than allow a commercial company to say, that bit's ours. I mean, you know, you didn't see Wells Fargo descending, right, this bit here, California, that's ours. The state will do what it thinks it needs to. But that's not to say these guys aren't going to be huge players, the way that Carnegie was a huge player, or I forget the guy that set up Alibaba. You know, they are major players, and they have very loud voices, sometimes quiet enough that we don't even notice them, but in the corridors of power they're loud. And it will be the same with space. Who's the other one? It's Musk and the Americans.
Bezos. Great.
Pardon?
Bezos? No.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos, yeah, right. They are each other's nemesis.
Yeah.
They really don't like each other very much. They used to get on absolutely fine, and it's space that they've fallen out on. It basically seems to come down to whose rocket is bigger than the other person. It really does.
This podcast is sponsored by Main Brace, which is a premium golden rum. Run by a family based in Cornwall and sourced in the Caribbean. Its name is a nod to the naval tradition of splicing the main brace, which was a tough ask on a ship and was rewarded with rum when completed. However, it's now come to mean a toast to victory. It's a very smooth drink that is delicious on its own, simply paired with tonic or ginger ale, and also in rum-based cocktails. It's just won a gold at the Rum Masters and has a unique flavor thanks to it being a blend of two styles of rum, one from Guyana and one from Martinique, two styles which have never been bottled together before. If you go to mainbracerum.com, use the promotional code CheersTim when you buy a bottle of Mainbrace Premium Golden Rum or Mainbrace Navy Strength Rum, you get a free case of Fevertree Tonic Water. So use the promo code CheersTim. This promotion is available until May the 31st. Back to the podcast, sponsored by Mainbrace Premium Golden Rum. Just a couple more things on space, and then we'll move on. But what's always interesting is when you speak to an astronaut, they always assume they're going to go out and they're going to look out at the universe. They never do. They look back at Earth, and it's called the overview effect. And they always become obsessed with Earth, and they're magnified into what they can do, the overview effect. And they can't believe that there's so many disagreements with. You mentioned in your book, we should be taking the leaders up there, basically, shouldn't we?
It is akin, they, most of them say, to a spiritual experience.
Yeah,
you know, it's not exact because they're not exact. But it may just be awe-inspiring, whatever awe is. I shook hands with John Glenn once, which was, you know, I mean, I'm not given to heroes, but, you know, what's that great line from Black Grape? Neil Armstrong, astronaut, yeah, something bigger than King Kong, first big suit on the moon, he's off to play golf. Because he, anyway, where was I? Yeah, there's a famous photograph called Earthrise, and it was the first photo taken from the moon looking back at Earth. And, and I think it's where Carl Sagan, the great American astronomer, got the phrase pale blue dot. Because there it was, hanging, this pale blue dot hanging there in the vastness. And of course, if you're out there looking back at it, it just looks so fragile. And every single one I've ever read says, they immediately think of oneness. They immediately think that, you know, there is no such thing as different types of humans. You know, it's just there, and that's our home. And this photo, Earthrise, had a massive effect on the green movement in the 60s. And to this day, I think it, looking back at it, it is a reminder, you know, that we're all cousins and we share the place. It doesn't mean that we immediately all become hippies and sort out the world's problems. But as a photo, I like it. And as a concept,
when the astronaut said to me, you feel this overview effect and it feels great. And you think that everything's at peace and at one. And you just have this amazing feeling. Then you, as he put it, you get on the interstate, someone cuts you up and you're right back to fuck you.
Yeah.
And he says, you realize it, how it all works. Finally on that, because people look back and stuff. And I think people go, why are we wasting money? I brilliantly today on Instagram, someone put a post up which said, stop trying to send people to Mars and plant some bloody trees. And I thought that's so naive. The population of the world has doubled in my lifetime. The population of the UK has gone up 20%. Life expectancy of this country has gone up 7 or 8%. 7% of humans ever born are alive today. We've really populated our planet. I think it's okay to do it. But we're not going, hold on, let's stop medicine now. We're increasing it. And so there's going to be more people living for longer. Yeah. And we've done podcasts on this. And when you go to space, you actually learn stuff. And I think it's not about getting people to Mars. It's about what you're learning by going up there. And that's a point you make in your book, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we owe it to future generations to do this for a number of reasons. I mean, there's the sort of doomsday scenario where, oh, in 5 years' time, that meteorite's going to hit us, and it doesn't matter how many nuclear weapons we fire at it, the Earth's going to be destroyed. So at least we've got these colonies and we'll carry on, if that's important. I think it probably is. Or as mundane as those silver foil things you wrap around you at the end of the marathon. They came out of the space race.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's some incredible research has already been done on the International Space Station that can only be done in space, which has had medical applications here. I mean, it's real cutting edge medical applications. And I have fun over a page or two in the book, in that chapter, looking ahead 10, 15, 20, 30 years, you know, where the price of gold has just collapsed because we found an asteroid with more gold on it than has ever been mined in the history of humanity. But we already know about the asteroids that have got more rare earth materials on them than the US economy is worth, you know, $30 trillion. And I would rather get up there and dig them out of there than the child labor in the Central African Republic and the conflicts that are assisted on Earth and all the pollution. Now, that's a race against time. You know, we are years away from properly mining outside of the Earth. And I completely understand this idea of plant some trees and put some money into welfare. But if you only ever, but you plant trees for the future. You know, this is a form, I think, of planting trees out there. And I just think it is our destiny. And it's a hard argument because you can sound heartless because you should immediately put in those billions into the welfare state, perhaps. But we do owe it to our descendants.
I think the way you bring it home best in the book is when you're in space, there's no water. So they recycle the water and they manage to recycle 97% of the water, which you said in your book. So they manage to keep 97%. So it's their urine and their sweat and their washing. They recycle it. So it's drinking water and it's pure water again. That is unbelievable. So you take that to any country, and no country, I don't think, is as has as little water as there is in space. So you take it to any country and go, okay, we can do this now. We can work out a way of recycling our water. It's perfect. It's the
And you know, if we had time, would have if I'd have prepared properly. Must forgive me. I could have a list here. If I just looked it up on the internet. And it would be a very long list of things that the science of space travel has given us now that we apply here now on Earth. And on that, among the most important things would be the medical applications. Yeah. It's a long, long list of things that we have been helped by.
Yeah. Okay, that was the second chapter I read in your book, Space. The first chapter I went to...
Did you read the newspapers from the back with the sports first? I did that.
Yeah, that's it. I went straight to the back of the pages. Was the United Kingdom, obviously. I went there because I'm self-indulgent. I wanted to know what's going on. And what's brilliant about your book is we've got very short memories of what this island is and, you know, how we were at war with each other constantly throughout the history of time. It's been a very short period of time, really, that we've come together as United Kingdom. And it's quite, you know, I'm like everybody else. Oh, the Scottish want to go, let them go. It's not a good idea, is it? And it's not a good idea for them. It's not a good idea for us. It's not a good idea for any of the countries in the United Kingdom to do this, really. And it seems like it's going to happen.
Not convinced. Okay, cool. Let's take it one by one. I don't say one way or the other whether I think it's a good idea, but I don't mind saying that I personally believe we're better together, that I'm British first and English second, although that's quite a rarity, I think. I think we're better together for a whole bunch of reasons that we haven't got time to go into, but I do believe very strongly that if there is a second referendum and if there is a clear majority for independence, I think as a democratic country, they have to go. I mean, Spain and Catalonia is not an exact comparison, partly because of the Spanish constitution, the way it's worded, and the way the Catalonian referendum was held. So it's very, very legally complicated. So you can't just say, oh, the Spanish were dictatorial because they didn't let Catalonia go. It's very complicated. I think the Brits would say, okay. But I think when you look at the United Kingdom, how small it is, how big the world is, splintering its population, messing up its codifications, having to go through the various trade issues that we would have, the potential economic pain it would cause Scotland, at least in the short term and possibly for longer, I think we're better together. At which point, if you're a certain type of Scottish nationalist, you're screaming at me, but I don't think that would be necessary because that's just an opinion. My opinion is only insulting if I say to you, even if you say that, you're not going. That's a different argument. If they choose, they can be independent. One of the things, I mean, this is a separate argument. The Rump UK would be diminished, not least because of its force in the world, both by population size, physical size, military size, economic size, you name it. But, you know, that's not an argument for Scotland not to be independent if it chooses to be.
Yeah, but even in the thing you mentioned in your book, how confusing it's going to be for us all, because we keep our nuclear subs in Scotland, yeah. And they're going to submarines, and they're going to say you can't, and then we're going to have to be subservient to USA. So suddenly, and then I assume Scotland won't have any military power at all in the
world. It would have an army. We would divvy it up. You know, that would be exceptionally difficult. But you might divvy it up. The English probably would say, right, we'll divvy it up under a population size. So there's 55 million of us and 3 million of you, 5 million of you, so you can have X percent. And the Scots would say, no. Let's divvy it up on territory size. So we want almost half. So you get into that immediately. But no, but Scotland would be, I was going to say given, that would take its share of the planes, the ships, the uniforms, the rifles, you name it. They wouldn't. I doubt they would have a major expeditionary force, but maybe they wouldn't want one. And on the nuclear weapons, you know, I am aware there'll be many people, Tim, that would say, great, we don't want any nuclear weapons. I'm not making an argument for or against it. I'm simply pointing out that in the event of Scottish independence and the SNP is wedded to a non-nuclear Scotland, we're going to have to build another base. It's going to take 10 years, billions of pounds that we don't have. And Scotland probably wouldn't be allowed to join NATO. So it wouldn't have a security umbrella because you have to allow visits by NATO warships if you're a NATO power. And the NATO warships are not under an obligation to declare if they have nuclear weapons aboard or not. So Scotland probably couldn't join NATO under those particular terms. I mean, oh man, what a minefield.
It's so confusing, isn't it? The world. We're an island, and you know, you make that point, and that's been quite good for us, hasn't it, in history?
I think very good. There are some negatives. We have at times been insular, even when we were out there. Really, well, we still are out there on the sea waves, but really out there, we were somewhat insular. But I think that insularity geographically has absolutely protected us from the extremes of European politics, mostly in the past, but there are even one or two signs now. But when Europe had its interminable wars, the 30-year war, the 100-years war, when it turned to fascism, when parts of it turned to communism, the Brits didn't go anywhere near it. Well, some of the wars they dabbled in on the periphery, but only so that one giant force did not arise to dominate Britain. For example, that's why they allied with people against Napoleon. That's why they allied against people against Germany. Make sure no one power arises. But it has protected us from those excesses of rampant ideology and harmful, I would argue, ideology. It's also allowed us our geography where we sit to have a massive trading bloc right opposite us that we can sell goods to. And now we're not in the EU, we're going to have to get that politics and economics right. And also direct access to the sea lanes of the world. Nobody can stop us. Swiss Navy would have much more of a problem. And an indented shoreline, meaning deep water ports. So all those things. And sorry, just to bring it up to date, I don't know, did you notice the recent open letter the French general sent?
No.
Oh, geez. 24 senior ex-generals. I mean, you know, the commander retired of the entire gendarmerie, the former head of the Foreign Legion, you name it, it's that level. Mm-hmm. They signed this open letter saying to Macron, if you don't pull your finger out and stop tearing this country apart and allowing the Islamic hordes, I think that was the term they used, to keep coming to this country, you are risking, brackets, we are threatening, a military coup.
Wow, in France.
Yeah. 24 senior retired. Can you imagine the British military? And it's just unthinkable. But that was a reminder to me. Oh, by the way, Le Pen, from the National Rally, former Front National, National Front,
yeah,
supported the letter.
Right.
And she is probably going to come second, might even win the presidency in the next presidential election.
Wow.
So can you imagine a British politician? So
she's doing better than her dad did, didn't she?
Oh, God. She doubled the vote. Her dad got 17% against Chirac. She got about 34% the last time out. And the next time out, she's forecast to sail through to the second round. And then only because people will then pull in behind the other candidate, probably Macron, only that's the only thing that's going to defeat her. Sorry, but the point being that I think this geography of ours has protected us from those excesses of politics, which to this day are still deep inside the body politic of some of the continental countries.
What's funny about this is I talk about this on the podcast a lot. I've got three generations, my parents, me, and then my kids, all really politically engaged. And we all discuss things all the time. And what's very funny is my mum keeps saying to me and my children, you've got very short memories. Now, obviously I saw war in the Middle East and Falklands. So I don't have a short memory of what it's like to go to war. Now it didn't really affect us sitting over here in Britain. It affected my parents a lot. Well, my mum, she was evacuated. So she hates things. So she always hates Europe a bit. there's a bit of her which hates it because she didn't have a good childhood, right? So she goes, you guys, my kids are really into the idea of getting rid of all nuclear weapons and all that. And I was like, hold on, but we've been to war. We don't need, you know, and I remember Thatcher and all that sort of goings on. So it's funny, the stories you hear and the stories you tell. So obviously we know Russia still talk about the Second World War a lot to their children and everything. Yeah. So it's funny, isn't it? We've got to be careful what stories we're telling each other.
Yeah, I mean, that includes us, of course, and being too anxious or nervous and too willing to have these nuclear weapons without, you know, at least going through the rights and the wrongs of is how threatened is Sweden? On the other hand, how big a player is Sweden? All those arguments.
Yeah.
But what I do think that the generations below us, I think there is a tendency to think of war as a very old-fashioned 20th century thing that doesn't really affect us, but it's sadly still present.
How safe do you think we are?
Oh, very.
Okay.
For the foreseeable future. But let's have a think. In 1932, Germany was on its knees with no army, not a threat to anyone. And 9 years later, it was at the gates of Moscow. 9 years.
9 years, yeah, it's not long, is
it? So there is trouble on the periphery. I mean, Sahel, you know, we are the British Army, and hardly anybody knows this, is fighting in the Sahel region just below the Sahara. There's 250 Brit troops down there from the Lancers. Bengal Royal Lancers, British troops, fighting alongside 6,000 French troops in the Sahel. And the instability is creeping upwards to the shores of the Mediterranean. I mean, that's just across the water from the European continent. We have a place in the world where we have friends and we need to come to their help. Three of those friends are the Baltic states. It is not inconceivable that they would not be invaded by Russia. I don't think they will be, for various reasons we don't have time for. So are we arguing that we don't have any allies or friends that we will say will help you? Okay, then you're going to be completely on your own. And then who knows what the world's going to be like in 9 years' time? So, you know, it's a tough ask. I personally think we need to stand by the Baltic states and their democratic right to be a member of NATO.
It's so complicated. And then we throw into the mix, as you mentioned earlier, cryptocurrencies, which are changing the world in various ways, and also the internet, which is a huge factor. How much do you think that's changing geography?
Not very much.
Oh.
Maybe I would say that, Tim, you know, but I'll admit to, when it comes to both crypto and the effects of the internet, I'm not sure I really know that much about it. There's a lot of people who do know a lot more, but I think even they Can't really know. I think people will look back at how the world was technologically, say, in 1995, and then in 2045, 50 years on, and there will be this stark difference of how we did business and interacted and lots of other things, and all the startups that came out of the dot-com generation. But I don't think we know yet. Now, the reason I don't think it affects the geography as much as many people do, is because I'm still looking, not even granular, but both granular and broad brush. The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is being built by Ethiopia to tap the waters of the Blue Nile, which start in Ethiopia. They will then, when it's finished, have their hands on the tap of the Nile. Without the Nile, Egypt dies. And the 105 million people that live there leave. Now, they're not going to cut the water off entirely, but it is the geography of what I've just laid out that is the important thing about the relationship between those two countries. It's the geography that is now forcing Egypt to already start to try to relocate some of its farming and also to switch some of its farming away from more water-intensive crops, simply because 800 miles away or whatever it is, another government has decided to put some concrete over some water. That's geography. And I can give you 100 examples like that. And it's every bit as valid now as it was 100 years ago.
I suppose the one thing we're realizing as well a lot is how corrupt we always just believe in Britain, we're the best, aren't we, and there's nothing, we've never done anything bad. I mean, someone like you someone like you doesn't, but the British public like me sit around going, yeah, we're the good guys, and then suddenly you start looking at how much we've got ourselves involved in world politics. For such a small little island, we've been very instrumental, haven't we, in what's happened in the world.
I mean, the Sahel is an example. That's more the French. But part of the reason why five countries in the Sahel could become fail states, which is why we're down there to try and stop that, at their invitation, I should add, is because of the shape of those countries, where they threw together people that had absolutely nothing to do with each other and said, right, you're a people now. I mean, the best example is Mali. You go to Timbuktu and north, and it's mostly lighter-skinned Tuareg, Arabic speaking, form of Arabic speaking, and it's pretty scrubland desert. And then south of Timbuktu, once you get past the river towards the capital, it's black Africans. And they don't feel they've got a great deal in common, but the French told them, you're all one people now, get on with it. And they were fighting each other before the French turned up, and they're still fighting each other now. But, you know, we didn't help. Yeah, we did forms of that in many parts of the world. Look, it's become exceptionally unpopular, and you risk getting cancelled if you say there was anything good about the British Empire. There's nothing good about the concept of the British Empire, and there's nothing good about colonialism, and there's absolutely nothing good about slavery. But there are some good things about railway lines and scientific advancements and civil services and education. And the empire did, as well as all its evils, engender some of those things. Now, to your first point about we're the good guys, we're certainly not the worst of the bad guys. You know, I mean, there's 193 countries. We could rank them if we had time and knowledge. That would either of us have either required. And if you look at a balance sheet of countries in the 21st century and what they do in the world, the UK, on balance, probably comes out as one of the least worst options.
Right.
Now, you know, that's different towards waving the flag and saying Britain's the best country, you know, but we don't need to beat ourselves up too much about who we are now, but we do need to pretty much educate ourselves a bit more than we already have about what we were and what flowed from what we were, as well as not being frightened to say some of the more positive elements of an overall negative experience.
Do you still get out and about and get to visit other countries? Or
no, sadly not. COVID notwithstanding. No, last place I went was Italy 2 years ago. No, I've got a lung condition called bronchiectasis. You might be able to tell from the voice. I've had pneumonia a number of times. The specialist said that the various extra helpings of super strong tear gas that you've drunk over the years really hasn't helped, nor have several of the places you went to that had all sorts of burning detritus, all over the place. And who knows what you sucked in places like Iraq. And traveling by plane is not too clever for me. If you have a compromised immune system and a compromised lungs, air travel, not because of the pressure, simply because of there's a lot of germs on there. And so I try to keep germish free. It's not going to stop me.
You miss it.
Do what?
Do you miss it?
Luckily, not particularly.
Good.
Number of reasons. One, planes are crap anyway, aren't they? I mean, Jesus.
I mean, do you miss the traveling through those foreign countries, looking at what's going on?
I don't miss traveling to them. Right. I do miss traveling through them. Absolutely. I do not miss, especially in the early days before the kit got smaller. Honestly, you'd rock up in Beirut Airport with 30 big metal cases. You try getting that through Beirut Airport at 2 o'clock in the morning when all you want to do is go to bed. No, I don't miss that at all. I do miss traveling through, learning and seeing. I'm a nerd. I see a statue. Who's that? Oh, why? And through that, you learn the touchstone, the touch points of a country. Now, why have you got a statue of that person? What did he do? What does he mean to you? Or the place names? Yeah, I miss that. But I have this stock phrase that I have no regrets about doing it, and I have no regrets about leaving it. You know,
that's got to be your next book, hasn't it? Statues of the World, who people celebrate and where they celebrate. And that could be an interesting idea. Do you get frustrated finally, Tim, looking at people like me who are so ignorant of what's going on in the world? You know, I'm representative of everyone in this country, and we sit here allowed to have a vote. we're voting for whoever's going to do the potholes in our roads, as you know, and yet there's so much going on we know so little about.
I don't get frustrated. I think we are a relatively well informed country compared to many others, and I think that when you've got to pay the electric bill as you have and put a roof over your head and all the rest of it, people haven't got that much time. There is only so much you can influence, again, given time, because most of us don't want to be activists, and many activists are very boring. Perhaps you need them, I don't know. But I don't. The only thing that does frustrate me sometimes is that people talk about the issues that you and I have just been talking about using what I call the language of the high priests. And that's just a turn-off for most people. And they couch the concepts that we've been discussing in terms that most people can't necessarily follow. I hope that's not too patronising. And there's no need to. There really is no need to. That I find frustrating. And so I think if we did talk about concepts in a more accessible manner, we'd do even better. But no, you know, we're still an educated country. Every society always has its complete know-nothings. And as you well know, Tim, you are not one of them.
Ah, well, I try and educate myself by reading books like yours. I'm serious.
I love what you did then.
Your books are always brilliant. I always love reading them. I always learn so much. The Power of Geography, the 10 Maps That Reveal the Future of Our World. Go and get it, because it's such a great read. Thanks a lot for joining me, Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.